I think it was W.C. Fields who said that he would never work with children or small animals. And after the children's sermon, I think I know what he meant. I mean, really, kids, not one of you would look in that bag while I was gone? I don't know what to say. So let's see. Last week, we left our story of God's covenant with promises made to Abraham and by the God who is more than enough, El Shaddai. Now, it'll come to you as no surprise that the promises El Shaddai made to Abraham have indeed come true. Abraham and Sarah had a beautiful baby boy named Isaac, and Isaac begat, to quote the King James, Isaac begat Jacob and Esau, and Jacob was the father of 12 boys, including the infamous Joseph. More on him later, though. Later, God appears to Jacob and reiterates the promise that he had made to his grandfather Abraham. God says this to Isaac: "Your name is Jacob. You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." And thus he called him Israel. God said to him also, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come forth from you. The land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give to you, and I will give the land to your descendants after you." Notice when God renews his covenant with Jacob that there's a name change. Sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? Didn't that happen last week with Abram and Sarai, with name changes? Well, Jacob does indeed prosper, just as God promised, and with 12 sons, not counting daughters, he does indeed multiply as well. Now, his favorite son, Joseph, the brat of the family, winds up being sold into slavery in Egypt by his jealous brothers. As for slavery, Joseph has a bad start and runs afoul of Pharaoh's wife and is thrown in jail. He ultimately rises to become the number two man in all of Egypt, and because God keeps him informed of what the future will hold in dreams, he's able to stockpile food and save Egypt from famine. Well, his rotten brothers come to Egypt looking for food during the famine, and the family is reunited and settled down in Egypt. And for 400 years following, God's people increase in number and do indeed become a mighty nation. And then we read this in Exodus. "Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, 'Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we are. Come, let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply, and in the event of war, they will join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and leave the land.' So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor, and they built for Pharaoh storage cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out, so they were in dread of the sons of Israel. The Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to hard labor, and they made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks, and at all kinds of labor in the fields, all their labors which they rigorously imposed on them." You know, it seems that when God makes a promise, when God covenants with us, then nothing will stand in the way of that covenant. The more Pharaoh tries to keep the Hebrews down, the more they multiply. And as a last resort, he instructs the Hebrew midwives to kill all the newborn male children, a last-ditch effort to stop that promise of multiplication. Like when Herod tries the same thing 1,300 years later. You know the story. Moses survives and is raised in Pharaoh's house. He kills an Egyptian who's beating a Hebrew and escapes to the desert. And there he meets Jethro and gets a job as a shepherd and marries Jethro's daughter. Then one day God appears to Moses there and says, God called to him from the midst of the burning bush and said, "Moses, Moses." And Moses says, "Here I am." Then he said, "Do not come near. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." He also said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob." Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Well, as they say, the rest is history. Think Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments, right? You know how the story goes. Think Charlton Heston. Moses leads the people out of slavery. Pharaoh's armies pursue and are destroyed in the Red Sea. The people grumble about the food. They grumble about the lack of water. And just about anything else they can grumble about, they grumble about. When they come to Mount Sinai, Moses goes up to the mountain and brings down the Ten Commandments. And that's where the lesson for today starts. After giving the Ten Commandments written on stone tablets by God's own hand to the people, Moses returns to the mountaintop for many days and receives the rest of what we call the law with a capital L. All 613 rules and regulations for Israel to follow. 613. The law governs every facet of life. In truthfulness, the Ten Commandments are not anything special or any more important than any of the other 613 items of the law. And this is what God says to Moses as he gives him the law. He says, "This is what you are to say to the descendants of Jacob and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites." 700 years it took to get to this point from when God made the initial covenant with Abraham. 700 years, and a lot had happened to the people during that time, and their knowledge of El Shaddai, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph, the God who was their everything, well, it had all but disappeared. And they were not used to living in a community as a free people. If you remember, God had commanded Abram to be blameless and to be spotless before him. That was no longer possible for Israel by this time. They had forgotten too much of their identity and too much of what God required of them in their time as slaves in Egypt. Their memories had failed them after 700 years. I think that God gave them the gift, the good gift. And yes, the law is a good gift. I think God gave them the good gift of the law so that they could regain their spotlessness and their blamelessness. I think God gave them the gift of the law so that they would know who they were to be and how they were to live together between themselves and with God as God's precious children. But that's not exactly how things turned out. You know, I think it's because of Newton's third law. Okay, what's Newton's third law? There's always a science nerd somewhere, right? For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Newton's third law. What God intended was for the law to help fashion us into a kingdom of priests and holy nations. That's the purpose of those 613 laws, of which the Ten Commandments are 10 of them. A kingdom of blameless and spotless people. But what happened? You might remember Paul writing in Romans, "What shall we say then? Is the law sin? May it never be. On the contrary, I would not have come to know sin except through the law. For I would not have known about coveting if the law had not said, 'You shall not covet.' But sin, taking opportunity through the commandment, produced in me a coveting of every kind. For apart from the law, sin is dead. I was once alive apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin became alive and I died. And this commandment, which was to result in life, proved to result in death for me. For sin, taking an opportunity through the commandment, deceived me and through it killed me. So then the law is holy, and the commandment is holy and righteous and good. And he goes on to say, therefore, did that which is good become a cause of death for me? May it never be. Rather, it was sin, in order that it might be shown to be sin by effecting my death through that which is good, so that through the commandment, sin would become utterly sinful. That's Paul. And he goes around and around a lot, does he not? But I think what he's saying about the law is this. The law, which is God's good gift to us, is indeed good, always was and always will be. But we as humans, tainted by sin, we cannot keep the law. What happens instead is it winds up condemning us. Instead of keeping us from becoming idolaters and adulterers and coveters and liars and thieves and murderers by telling us what's right and wrong, it has the opposite effect. And you know how that goes, right? That's where temptation comes in. Well, you know what? Think of Adam and Eve and the snake. When the snake appears to Eve, go ahead, eat the apple. Did God really say, if you eat the apple, you'll die? He just doesn't want you to be as smart as he is. And you know what happens. And you know yourself. Thou shalt not steal, just like kids, right? I know what's right and wrong, but I'm only borrowing forever. My buddy Joe wouldn't care. He'd want me to have it, wouldn't he? That saw that's been in my garage for the last 5 years that I borrowed from the neighbor. You know how sin goes. Because sin lives in us, we can't help but do those things. And as a result, the law winds up condemning us, sort of like writing all of our shortcomings on our foreheads for everyone to see. Instead of saving us from sin, the law reminds us that, in fact, we are nothing more than a bunch of idolatizing, adulterating, murdering thieves. Does that make sense? Do you like to hear that? It's sort of like receiving a beautiful red sports car for your 50th birthday. Guys, you know the midlife crisis, right? The car's not bad. In fact, the car is awesome, isn't it? It's when you give in to temptation and go too fast on the road and have an accident. That's bad. The law is not bad. It's sin in us that looks at the do-nots and makes us think more like, why the heck not? And after we begin to think, why the heck not, for a while, it becomes all too easy to give in and do those do-nots in the Ten Commandments. So does that help you understand Paul and his talking about the law and sin any better? And that's where the law, that's where the covenant begins to go bad for us. When our human nature makes us question God and God's covenant with us. And things go very bad indeed. But more on that next week. You see this table over here? Here we find forgiveness. Here we find mercy. Here we find strength. Here we find hope. Thank God for our God in the person of Jesus Christ. So come to the table.